Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded, though, by people who can support us, your family, friends, and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. In the previous episode, Carrie Sutton shared her insights into how we promote and protect children's mental health and well-being. We don't know what we don't know until we're faced with a situation where we learn what we need to know, a story we can all identify with, which leads me to my guest today. Deborah Fay is a parent, counsellor, author, publisher, and book coach. With diplomas in holistic counselling, life coaching, and meditation teaching, her personal story is one of twists and turns that have culminated in her decision to helping other women share their stories. Passionate about education, with a desire to understand how hidden toxins in foods and household products impact mood, behaviour, learning, and childhood development, it was Deb's own education that formed the solid foundation and acceptance of change she would need raising her family through adversity. Welcome, Deborah. I'm intrigued to know how your own education shaped your values.
The school I went to was a Franciscan school, so based on St. Francis of Assisi's values, and I really resonated with those, and otherwise I think I would have been out of there. And I've seen that happen, you know, with my kids and their peers. When your values don't align with the school, you don't stay long. So being community minded and, you know, giving to people less fortunate, you know, they're values that I hold high. Being amongst the girls, I love my girlfriends. I love, you know, not that I was liked and fit in with every single person at school, like everyone else, I guess. But yeah, I do appreciate my girlfriends and my girl time. I think that's been an impact on me from that experience, and probably from my family too. My mother came from a large family, lots of girls, had a very good relationship with my grandmother, and just enough boy interaction that, you know, kept life interesting. But I really didn't like boys. When I was younger, I really didn't, until, you know, mid-teens probably. I just found them quite annoying and, got in the way. And interestingly, that's sort of in my later years, so probably 10 years ago, I was working with boys in high school. So it's funny how things come around.
So you didn't have a brother, or, you know, in your family?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the reason.
Brother. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's, I love him dearly, and boy, he's mellowed. He's been a delight. But yeah, early years he was a little problematic, and he actually, even a conversation just recently, said that a friend of his said that he didn't think he would live to his 60s, and we both had a big laugh about that, and neither of us thought he would either. So he's an interesting person. He's full of character. Yeah.
What was the catalyst in your life that led you down the counselling path to begin with?
That would have started with our own circumstances. So I had a 14-year-old that was self-harming. And I'm really, really happy. We went to a counsellor. I was looking for a counsellor to help her. But what we found was a counsellor that helped all of us and worked with the whole family. And that was life-changing for us. You don't know that you don't have skills in certain areas until you're feeling the pain of that deficit. And then, you know, you find someone that you trust, and they tell you the truth about, you know, what you need and what's actually going on for you. And that, you know, if you allow that relationship to evolve, that can take you a long way. And so my husband and I and the kids, we all did quite a bit of work on ourselves. It was an interesting journey for probably 2 to 3 years, full on, after which my husband, we'd been in our own business, and you know that global financial crisis came along, and the phone stopped ringing for a little while, and we thought, well, maybe now's a good time to go and he was 45 at the time, might be a good time for him to go and work for someone else, put the tools down. So he did that, which left me to decide what I would do with my time and my future. And I consider myself pretty much unemployable and therefore self-employed. It's not a bad thing. And decided I wanted to study counselling. So, yeah, that's what I did.
So what was it about the counselling you received that helped you understand how your family had ended up in that position? Because a lot of the time society judges parents for where their children end up. And for someone who's dealing with a depressed child or a withdrawn child, someone who's self-harming or even has suicidal ideations, that can be quite scary.
Very confronting. And so confronting that for us, it made us act big. And fast. So having said that, the feedback that we did get from the counsellor that we landed with, she said that probably 95% of parents don't act in the same way, which surprised me. And I think most people are full. You know, they're full with the demands of life and just trying to get through each day. So the whole idea of then having to change, and you do have to change if you want things to change. That's the bottom line. Justin Herald was the first person I heard say, if nothing changes, nothing changes. And when you want change, when you really, really want it, you make it happen. You really do. You find the pathway. And I think every child's problem is a parent's problem. It's probably more than likely generational. Not always, but I would say, generally speaking, that is the case. And it is that lack of skill. It is that lack of knowing, you know, where you belong, what your worth is a big thing. Yeah, just your ability to be able to cope for yourself. There's a lot involved. It's very complex, I guess. So, but definitely it's a community thing. It's whether that's just the family unit or the broader community, it's definitely more than just one person's problem.
As a parent, how do you think you came away from that experience knowing something that you wish you'd known before?
Richer is the best word I can come up with. To the point where we all talk about it being a blessing that things happened the way they did and we had the opportunity then to change and make things better. But, you know, not that things were always horrible by any means. They just weren't right. The way we interacted, probably first and foremost. So our communication style, there was a lot more validation going on, a lot better listening. And those two things alone, I think, are enough to change a culture, whether it's a, you know, a family group, a larger community. So, listening, validation, letting people have their feelings and not out of fear, trying to squash them down or move them aside or invalidate them.
What did you learn about your daughter and the relationship you'd had with her to that point?
Oh, definitely could have done better, but didn't know better. And, you know, we're really probably just at a point now, like 20 years later from that, where they have a better understanding of themselves. And, you know, we just support them in coming to that place for themselves. So probably a pretty tight unit now as a family. Some big differences in our family from, you know, having a non-binary married to transgender at one end and then a very committed Christian child at the other end. And then one with autism. We have a variety of perspectives within the family and we actually do really, really well from that experience and from what came from it and learning to communicate. And we are respectful towards each other. We support each other in those differences. Sometimes it gets a little, but we do navigate our way through because of the skills we learned back then.
Hats off to you and deepest respect for having come through that as a tight unit, because I know each of those individual things you were talking about, they can put a lot of pressure on families and some of them don't come out the other end as well.
Yeah, it does. It certainly takes commitment to, you know, probably a bit like a marriage. You know, you commit every day to show up in, you know, the best possible version you can and support your partner. You just do it as a family unit. That's probably something else we did learn from that time was putting our, like I had a good relationship with my husband. We're great mates, but we were better after that time. And we understood that putting ourselves, you know, and making sure that we were tight created a better space for the kids. So that was good. And we're still, you know, really tight now. So I've been really blessed there with that relationship.
The family dynamics is something we can only learn from our parents. So what did you take from the modelling your parents had presented you, you and your husband, that you either embraced or changed in your parenting?
Honestly, I think our parenting was unconscious until we did go and see somebody and we didn't really think too much about, you know, I don't like this, I don't like that. I think we just took it for granted. There are addictive issues within both sides of the family, divorce on my husband's side, some issues with step-parenting. So, you know, probably things that people these days, it's quite normal to be dealing with those things. So we didn't really think, you know, oh, I'm not doing that, or, you know, we're definitely doing that. We were just who we are, and we just went, okay, well, what do we need to do in this situation? And it was very unconscious. And maybe that is a large part of the problem, you know, for families these days. We're not conscious until we need to be. And even then, sometimes we don't become conscious as we need to be. Until the unconscious becomes conscious, it will rule our life and we will call it fate. Great saying. And it's that's pretty much sums up the change in our lives, you know, through that time. Parenting, I think, even with our parents, was unconscious as well. They were just doing the best they could. And we were doing the best we could, and then we found out we had to do better, or if we wanted better, we needed to do better, and we needed to find out how. You know, going to a counsellor or a parenting coach or something like that is actually a really good experience if you let it be, because, well, what family can't enjoy better circumstances? You know, even a healthy family can still do things better. And there's a book that actually is, the title is The Opposite of Dysfunction is Just Another Form of Dysfunction. You know, so every family has something that, you know, it's probably like yin and yang. One doesn't exist without the other. So even if you're mostly functional, there'll still be a little bit of dysfunction that you can work on and make life better. So why wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think that goes for all of us as individuals, let alone parents, that we can always improve on something. It's just our ability to adopt and embrace change. And that is something that humanity as a whole, it seems to have a fear around. You mentioned earlier that your counselling journey took you to working with adolescent boys. And I'm wondering, you know, what did you take away from that experience where you've been able to leverage your own family experience in talking to those boys?
Interestingly, the boys used to ask me about my kids. So there was just a short stint that I did. That wasn't what I did all the time. And so I used to present for the Friends program. Which is about emotional resilience, and started with younger groups and did preteens. And then the lady that I was working with was asked if we could adapt the program for a flexi school north of Brisbane. And so we did. We adapted it for them. We got some help, and then I delivered the program. It was for four grades over like half a semester. Phenomenal experience. Eye-opening, and I probably learnt more than what the boys did. One thing I did really struck me when I started that program was how much those boys wanted to find a way to change themselves. You know, they were struggling with something. Lots of them had like ADHD, ASD, intellectual difficulties. So they really wanted to change. They wanted a different experience. And they were so hopeful that, you know, what we delivered would make a difference for them and that they would get along better with other people and they would be able to manage themselves better in circumstances than what they had been. That really, really stuck with me and filled me with hope, to be honest, and made me realize that when there are things there for people that actually address what's happening underneath for people and address the actual needs. We had the head of campus at the school where my kids went through. She said one day, a child whose needs are met does not have behavioral issues. And when you approach, I guess, teaching, whether it's as a parent, as a psychologist, as a counsellor, as a school teacher, when you approach teaching from that perspective, it actually changes how you communicate with the person sitting in front of you. So hopefully you're not so overwhelmed with what you have to get across and ticking boxes that you can actually take the time to get it across in a way that meets the need of the person in front of you. That would be the ideal thing. So when there are resources available that actually meet the needs, change happens. It does happen. And it can happen quite easily, I believe. So it's just getting those parts of the formula right.
The world has changed so rapidly over the last 50 years, and a lot of that comes down to technological advancement and exposure, I think, for our children, but particularly boys, because I think they're more drawn to risk of behaviours as well as looking at gaming. From your view of adolescence as we were growing up, how different was it to be speaking with these boys, and how much has it changed in relation to the challenges they face?
I feel very much for young men, and statistics, you know, are showing that the suicide rate, you know, between 15 and 45, the highest rate of death is via suicide, and Indigenous is a large portion of that. It's hard for them. It's really hard for them. And this is not a sob story and feel sorry for them. Something's not right in our society. And the circumstances that we're living in are actually putting pressure on those cracks. So, you know, the faster things are moving, this is just my perspective, the faster things are moving and the more that is expected of us because of technology, because of the shift in the relationship between men and women, because of the shift, you know, the empowerment of women, this is all pushing on cracks that have not been looked at enough. There are still needs there. And, you know, you can just say, I'll harden up and have a cup of concrete is a saying from, you know, my era. My brother would say that quite a bit. But it doesn't help. It just doesn't help things. What helps is having a look at what the needs are and addressing them. And then, you know, and if that's a bit of a sob story for a minute or two, let it be. And then we can go, okay, what do we do now? So there's issues. And even in the last 10 years since I was working with those boys and with other groups of children, there are more pressures. And there are cracks now being exploited even further, especially when, you know, with the likes of it's Andrew Tate and those sorts of people that are gaining huge followings from children, basically, who do not know who they are yet. And that will always be a problem. It's just exacerbated now. That's my thoughts.
As you were talking about empowerment for women and women becoming empowered, and that has taken us at least, you know, more than 50 years, and that's just in modern history terms, to even get the right to vote or feel like we had any other rights other than being a housemaker and a mother. When women have looked to gain, you know, a little bit more equality, it's been seen as a power struggle. However, it's not even about that. So how do you think we should be approaching these lost boys as a recent UK report coined it?
I love something that you posted recently about the alpha male, because that seems to be what people are coming back to. They think that's the way forward, is to get stronger, louder, more alpha, let's say. But I loved that perspective that you put forward without giving so much background, but just to say that, you know, like a computer program, it can be the alpha model. Then we have versions beyond that. So what if we all started looking at men from that perspective and say, okay, so you're in alpha mode, you know, where do you want to be and what are we going to do to get you there? Women are trying to tell men what they want. And mothers, I'm sure, are trying to raise self-aware boys that can, you know, not just go out and, you know, to have that pressure of being the breadwinner for their entire lives, but actually be someone who can contribute to the family emotionally and bring a lot of love and nurturing, which I actually think a man in his power has the absolute ability to do. He can be so nurturing, more nurturing than a woman in a bigger way. That's my experience. And I would love to see that for our younger men, have that opportunity to be all they can be. It's not about looks. It's not about strength. It's about being in your truth and being emotionally aware. And if those two things became the things that we honored and looked up to, society would change more toward that, and we would open doors for people to find that path. There has to be a point at which, you know, it will come back and there is a better balance between us and for us. It's going to benefit all of us if we're all in our power.
Well, if anyone knows about being in their power, I feel like it's you, Deb. What prompted you to publish a book and then empower other women to share their stories?
I'd always wanted to write a book from the time I was early teens. I started journaling through a program that we did at school, actually, and I just loved it and kept a journal for a long, 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 long time and just always thought I would be a published author. And I did actually send one book to a publisher, to a traditional publisher. What I did send off, I got some good feedback on, but I never followed it up. And life goes on and we were busy. And then learning all these skills, I thought, you know, this is something I would like to write about. But what happened in the meantime was a friend of mine, we'd gone down this path of taking all the potentially harmful chemicals out of our home and, you know, just using chemically safe things in food, in our home products. And this girlfriend of mine who was very, very good with that stuff decided that she might like to go into business and help other people do that. And I said, I'll help you. And we'll collect the stories from people we know that have done this and, you know, write about the results that they've got. And we'll turn it into like a little PDF that you can give away off your website. And we did that. We collated those stories. And then I thought, I'll just see if I can actually get it published. And I'll see what happens with this. And with the help of my son, who's very technically minded, we were able to self-publish. And we published on a print-on-demand platform that at the time was, it's the second biggest print-on-demand platform, and it was only a year old at the time, the technology. So it was early stages of print-on-demand. Amazon had been around for a little while, but the other one that we used, yeah, it was only a year old. It went really well. It was such an exciting thing. And we actually helped other people to become authors in that process, the other people who'd shared their stories. That was such a buzz. And I love the whole concept of helping people turn their stories into something that empowers them rather than something that keeps them stuck. You know, you don't have to change it. If you want to stay stuck and you're happy to be there, all power to you. But if you want to change something, you know, there is that sense of, in me, there is that sense of excitement about, well, what can happen next? Bringing that desire to be an author and then putting it together with some information that is actually really going to help people, and it's going to make people, you know, realize their dreams of becoming authors. This is great. And then the next book I just did myself was about around the resilience skills, and what I saw were what I call the six keys to happiness. And they're nothing to do with getting what you want, and everything to do with meeting your basic needs and being honest with yourself about who you are and living in that truth.
Deborah Faye, thank you so much for being with me today, for giving me your time and sharing your very personal story with me. I hope it helps others.
Thank you. It's been so much fun.
Counselor, author, publisher and book coach Deborah Faye, who founded Disruptive Publishing. If you're a woman with a story to tell, or you know a woman like that, all the links are in the show notes to connect you with Deb and Disruptive Publishing. Next week, we're uncovering that UK report we mentioned in this story, Lost Boys. It looks at six key indicators of life quality for youth, and the correlations to other countries like the US and Australia are astonishing. That fresh and frank conversation drops Friday, the 14th of June. This podcast is recorded in Launchpad Studios thanks to Greater Whitsunday Innovation, formerly Split Spaces.